here today to discuss qualitative research roles, some traditional and some non-traditional spaces we think about them. And we're very grateful to have our three panelists, Dr. Fenaro, Dr. Sanchez, and Dr. Cannon. And just to give you a little bit of background on the qualitative research SIG of ARA, we were established in 1983, and we provide a space for discussing philosophy, the ethical, methodological, and philosophical elements of qualitative research. And we really are looking to ensure the legitimization of non-traditional forms of research within academia and beyond. And we're really excited to provide this resource for grad students so we can have conversations around different avenues than we traditionally talk about in academia. So today we're gonna allow each of our panelists to kind of tell us their stories and their pathways in the nature of qualitative research. And then from there, we'll open it up for a Q&A from participants in the audience. If you have questions that are budding, feel free to put them in the chat as we go, and we will be sure to collect those at the right time. And with that, I wanna kick it off because I know we're a few minutes already into our space and hand it over to Dr. Fenaro to discuss her role as a non-academic qual job at the School District of Philadelphia.
Thanks, Katrina. Hi, everyone. I'm Liz Fenaro, and I currently work as a research specialist in the Office of Research and Evaluation. So I'm just going to give a little bit about my background and how I ended up in this role. And I think as we continue this morning, there'll be a space for questions. So just feel free to ask for any clarification or any more information on anything I share. So I went to Temple University, which is in Philadelphia, and I studied urban education. My dissertation was qualitative. It was loosely based on ethnographic methods, and it was on teachers' experiences with service learning and how service learning can be a mechanism for teacher retention. While at Temple, I also did work with an alternative certification program, and then I had a postdoc after I graduated at the Academic Center for Research on Diversity at Temple, and I was adjuncting at local universities at that time. Prior to grad school, I was a teacher in the School District of Philadelphia, and after grad school, I didn't want to relocate, so that was my main goal, to stay in Philadelphia and to utilize my PhD there. So I basically applied to any and all jobs in the city that I could find. I was looking at leadership jobs in schools. I was looking at jobs at universities, local research centers, service learning, leadership positions at universities. I had a few interviews, but none of them went particularly well. But I heard about my job on the Temple Urban Ed listserv. It happened that I walked at my graduation next to the person who posted the job. So I gave her a call and I discussed the position. And I really enjoyed my interview. I had a lot of fun during that conversation. So I knew the job was a really good fit. So as I said, my job's in the Office of Research and Evaluation. I was hired as a research specialist, and I'm now a senior research associate. The team I work with mostly does work that aligns nicely with my research agenda. Coming out of my PhD program, I kind of pitched my research agenda as mostly focused on teacher support and professional development. So my work is mostly evaluating a group of SNAP-Ed-funded community partners called Eat Right Philly, using a mixed methods approach. And Eat Right Philly goes into schools and supports schools and teachers in promoting the health and well-being of students. So we have done a major case study project that involves observations of that work and then interviews with Eat Right Philly staff and also school staff. So when I first started my job was mostly analyzing that data. It was data from 19 schools. So we got to focus on that for over a year, which I loved as a qualitative researcher. I've also led a study on school breakfast implementation, which included observations of school breakfast and interviews with school staff. And the SNAP-Ed grant that I work on funds dissemination. So we were able to publish on that piece. So I felt that all of the work and practice I got with publishing and my PhD program paid off there, and I got to continue that instead of completely dropping that skill set, which I appreciated. However, that's not the norm in my office. Our research is typically published on the school district's website, which I'll drop in the chat, so you can see our reports and our briefs. And that is a big difference for me. It's a different way of writing, where there's less emphasis on methodological detail, and the emphasis is more on packaging our results in a way that are accessible. So while I do get to do a lot of qualitative research, our office's goal is to support practice in the School District of Philadelphia. So the research really is whatever is needed at the time. I support evaluation of a variety of grants, which is mostly survey work. However, there is space to collect massive amounts of qualitative data from stakeholders, our parents and our guardians, our students and our staff, in the form of open-ended surveys and focus groups. So that's my absolute favorite thing to do in my job. And topics have been on school reopening during COVID, food access during COVID, and most recently top priorities for the district's new superintendent. So that's my favorite part. And I get to code all of the open-ended questions on, you know, these surveys and focus groups from stakeholders. And connected to that, because our research is often to answer questions that are most relevant at the time, I get to learn about topics and answer questions that I never would have come up with on my own. So I'm, you know, really stretched in that way. And I get to learn new information about topics, but also new research methods. So I think I'm enjoying not being in the driver's seat of my research agenda, and kind of getting things thrown at me that allow me to learn a variety of different skills and cover a variety of different topics. I think you're on mute, Katrina.
Yeah, you're on mute.
Of course. I clicked unpin, but not unmute. I was going to say thank you so much, Dr. Bernaro. And in transparency, I've had the privilege of working with you over the last year, and it's been really interesting to see qualitative research implemented in a practitioner sense, but also still maintaining strong methodology on the back end, even if it's not communicated to the general public all the time. So thank you for that. As we transition to Dr. Sanchez, I would love it if y'all could drop in the chat where you're from and what draws you today, so we can also make sure that we answer some of those questions in our Q&A as we go on. And with that, I will hand over the virtual mic to Dr. Sanchez.
Hi, everybody. So I know we started a little late. So can someone tell me, like, how much time do I have? Do I still have 10 or 15? I just want to make sure I don't go over.
Let's say 10.
Okay, perfect. So hi, everyone. My name is Shayna Sanchez. I am an assistant professor of qualitative research at the University of Alabama. I got my PhD in training at UCLA and in urban schooling with an emphasis on policy. So I was not, you know, trained to be a qualitative methodologist, but our program had a heavy qual emphasis. So I'm currently doing, I have been doing and still currently doing research on the experiences of girls and women of color in school settings. For my dissertation, it was girls of color who had experienced discipline and academic exclusion, so being tracked out of honors and advanced courses. And I started a research and mentoring group called the Lavender Girls Project for girls of color from Title I high schools that I'm working to expand at UA now and in Alabama. So the extension of that currently looks like a study that I'm doing about the experiences of women of color school administrators in the South. So I'm working to kind of expand my research and be more regional with it. I'm from a small island called Saipan. So I'll give you a dollar if you know where it is without Googling it. But it's a U.S. territory, so really similar to Puerto Rico. We moved to the U.S. when I was in my sophomore year of high school, and I've lived all over the South during my most formative adult years. So prior to going to UCLA, so I'd never lived on the West Coast, and I always knew I wanted to come back to the South because that's what felt most like home. So I guess I'll just go over, I mean, if it's okay, I mean, I can talk about all sorts of things, but I thought maybe what might be helpful is to talk about my journey through the job market. And it's just one person's journey, right? It's not the journey, but hopefully maybe it'll, you know, spark some questions or you'll get some ideas from it. So I went into the job market very softly. So they recommend that you, you know, keep your finger on the pulse of the job market a year or so before. So I kind of did some of like, just like perusing, and then COVID hit. So I had a really, that was really fun. And I had to kind of take a break and take, you know, like, okay, what am I going to do now? We're not sure where the world is going. So I just took that time to take another year and just try to, you know, figure out what I wanted to really do. But I think what was really important for me in terms of, you know, envisioning a tenure track career, especially after living in LA for so long, was knowing that I wanted to be back in the South. And so that was my boundary and that was my priority. So just checking in with yourself about what matters the most to you in terms of what you want in your career. And for me, I knew that I wanted to be in a place that felt like home and that where my community and my network was close by. So that really narrowed it down for me. People were sending me jobs from like Utah and like all of these like Midwestern cities, because that's where a lot of them were at the time, I think. And I was like, no, I don't know anybody in the Midwest. So, but yeah, so I just kind of went in and did, you know, a job at your classic like job matrix, found all the institutions, all the job posts, and really the only job that appealed to me and that was in the geographic location I wanted was this job that I have now. So so I had to have a backup plan. And my husband and I were like, okay, well, if this doesn't pan out, we have an RV, we're going to live in an RV for a year, and we're just going to travel and do all these like fun things that we didn't get to do during COVID. So so always kind of have like, okay, what would I do if I wasn't doing this that like, you know, makes me feel fulfilled and looking, and I knew I wanted to be in academia. I wanted to be in a tenure track position. So I wasn't really trying to look elsewhere. So yeah, so I kind of just put all my eggs in one basket, as they say, and it thankfully worked out. But I think also part of the reason it worked out was because I was very, very intentional. I read the call like a bajillion times, and I really made sure that all of my materials matched that call, which takes, I mean, I'm not even exaggerating. People say it's a full-time job to look for a job. And that's why I couldn't do that for every single job in the South that came up, the very few that did. So I really put a lot of time into that. And, you know, obviously worked out and I'm here now, but I think a huge part of the reason I'm here is because I had such a wide support of people who, really helped facilitate my success through this process. I couldn't have done it without people sharing their materials with me, without people looking at my cover letter, my CV, and just, you know, just really making sure that I was really putting my best foot forward and that I was matching what the university was looking for. So it's really important, I think, to not be afraid to share your materials, not be afraid to ask for other people's materials, to ask for examples. When you do your job talk, practicing, you know, as many times as you can. You know, it was funny, my husband was watching me. I mean, I was literally being in the house just talking to myself, practicing. And he goes, I feel like you're putting so much more time on this job search or talk than you ever did in your dissertation. And I was like, yeah, accurate. Like, you know, because for me, the stakes were extremely high. Like this was going to be the beginning of my career. And like the dissertation, it's like a slow burn, right? And the dissertation or the job is like, you know, you have a month to get all your stuff in. You have another month to prepare, maybe if that, for the first round interview. And then you have like a week or two before they fly you out for a second round. So I was, you know, what is it? Like my foot was like on the gas and we were just going. And so I think just making sure that you're able to sustain it in that brief period of time when you do get the calls and stuff and invites. And in terms of sort of transitioning into this position, I transitioned straight out of grad school. So I didn't have like a postdoc or anything. And it was like a bit jarring, you know, cause you go from like, and I was joking to my friends, I said, you know, I walked into the classroom and I was like, all right, well, when's the professor going to get here? And I was like, oh, wait, that's me. Like everybody's like, hey, you're responsible. So I think it's, and I'm still working through that, you know, finding my identity, as faculty, as somebody on the tenure track, and I'm very early. I'm in my second year, but so far I've really enjoyed it. I think I've landed in a really wonderful place, and my department's really supportive. But I wouldn't have, I think, again, gotten here if I didn't have all these people kind of guiding me and telling me what to look for, the right questions to ask, and making sure that the things that I was prioritizing were actually things that I, you know, that would be meaningful and important for the success of my, you know, being successful on the tenure track. So I think I'm at 10 minutes. I apologize that was like a little fast and like all over the place, but I'm happy to take questions or like discuss more like in detail and stuff. So.
Thank you, Dr. Sanchez. That was great. It wasn't all over the place. It was very realistic and practical. But I'm going to pass it on now to Dr. Cannon. Who is on mute?
Yeah, I was going to try to share my screen. Hold on one second. Good morning, everyone. I'm Susan Cannon. I'm at Mercer University. I'm in a math ed position, elementary and middle school math ed. And and it's not letting me share my screen the way I want. Okay. And I'm getting the rainbow circle of death. Okay. We're just gonna. So sorry. I've done this before. I usually use Google Slides and I was like, I'm gonna use a PowerPoint, but it's coming up on both of my screens. So this is what I'm gonna do. Okay. You're gonna see all the things and that's just gonna be fine. So I came to qualitative inquiry kind of accidentally. Sorry, I hope that's okay that you're just gonna see the behind the scenes stuff too. And in this interest of time. And I came through, I was a teacher for 13 years and then never thought I was gonna get my PhD. Kind of got recruited by a researcher that was doing research in my school and thought there's no way I can afford to live on $27,000 a year, like a fellowship. And then came around after 13 years of teaching to think maybe I could do that. And maybe I want some time to think about like what it means to be in education and how, whether I want to go back into the classroom or whether there's some other space for me in education where I can have an impact in the lives of children. So I work in the fields of mathematics education and statistics education. I'm really interested in university supervision and teacher ed and think across all of those fields. So I'm technically in math ed, but I think a lot about how do we move across fields and interact with different fields as we do research. So I'm going to talk for a minute about why I think it's productive to be in math ed doing qualitative research. I think that the discipline of math ed in particular is pretty structured and disciplined. And so I think bringing a different perspective into that space allows me to see difference and what difference makes. So this is a poster I presented at a math ed conference and people were walking past the poster and they were like, what is that? Because it didn't follow all the norms of the rules of the discipline. So I think that being in a space where you're a little bit out of step is helpful to my thinking as a qualitative researcher versus being in a space with other qualitative researchers. So I like to think about what difference makes, and thinking about how do I put things next to each other or hold them up against each other and draw lines between or make connections across. So MathEd really gives me that space to do that. I think with Bharat a lot about like knowledge making apparatus and thinking of the field of mathematics education as something that I'm interacting with and impacts the knowledge that I'm able to produce. And I think of that as both as a constraint that's really productive for me in some ways, and as a space where then I can push against those boundaries and edges and structures within the MathEd and try to open that space up a little bit through using qualitative methodologies and theories. So I'm going to just give an example of that. And I can talk a little bit about how I came to be here, but I thought it might be helpful to think about why I find this space productive. So an example that I can give is the idea of learning trajectories. It's a very prevalent area of research in mathematics education, is this idea of a learning trajectory. And a lot of researchers spend a lot of time figuring out how kids come to know things in order for teachers to be able to better teach it. And they're usually very linear. DeFreitas and Sinclair have critiqued that linearity and thinking about what that does. So it's this kind of like, first grade we learn this, second grade we learn this. And in a lot of classrooms right now, in math classrooms, you see teachers teaching I do, we do, you do, at not just in math, but in other subjects where the teacher does it, then the students do it with the teacher, and then they're allowed to do it on themselves. But it's a very linear kind of idea of what learning looks like as well. So I've been thinking with, this was an image from a walk that I went on while my son was playing soccer, and thinking about, well, what might it look like if we think about learning and learning trajectory as a moving around and through and around the field, and that the learning isn't something that we pass through, but it's something that we come around and around and around and interact at it from different angles and different spaces and different moments in time. So I was watching my son and his friends playing this game, and the different energies and the different perspectives on that. And what do I then come to know about soccer based on all these different spaces that I'm coming to it with? And I like to think with Catherine McKittrick and her, she talks a lot about where do we know from? So not just thinking, what do we want to know or how do we come to know, but where are we knowing from? So what are we bringing of ourselves and our cultures? And also like, what perspectives are we knowing from? So if we compare I think of the question of how does each function, not which is right or wrong, because I think the research on learning trajectories in MathEd is really important and powerful and informative. But I also think if we only think of learning trajectory in that way, then what does that do to what we think about knowledge? So I want to kind of think of both of these things together in a diffractive way of what happens when we think across learning trajectory as line versus learning trajectory as kind of path around. I'll leave with these couple of quotes, because my dissertation was situated in a math education classroom, but I did a diffractive analysis across different theories, looking at that, the data from that classroom to think about what difference the different ways of producing knowledge makes for what we come to know about a particular place or time. So, and my title was Doing Science, and I am kind of particular about calling it science, because I think that often qualitative inquiry can be seen as outside of science or other than, and I think it's important to continue to position ourselves as scientists who are doing scientific work. But I think that science must be understood as an adventure that allows us to tell our stories otherwise and to see other aspects of things, not better or worse, but how that those different ways of knowing and different ways of telling come up against maybe quantitative ways of knowing or other ways of knowing, that not to say better or worse, but to say these are all mattering in how we come to do our work. So I was hoping to kind of give a little hint to why I think being in a discipline as a qualitative researcher matters, and also to kind of think about a little bit of how I got here. And I'm happy to talk more about that if people have questions. But that's all I was going to say. Sorry about the slideshow. Thanks for coming.
No need to apologize for the slideshow. Anything people like me get excited about, data and visual things. Thank you for that, Dr. Cannon. We're going to open up for Q&A. So if you have questions, feel free to drop them in the chat. But I just want to kick us off with a question that I think you've each hinted at, but maybe to be pretty explicit about. And that is, what is the most rewarding and the most challenging aspect of being a qualitative researcher in your space? And any of you can answer that if you want to.
I can go. I mean, I think that somebody put in the chat about navigating the hegemony of quant. You know, I just wrote a career, an NSF grant this summer. So I think there's this balance of like being in the discipline and writing to disciplinary ways of being and adhering enough to that, but also at the same time, trying to think about how much can I push? So it's like, and there's money in math. There's lots of opportunities to get grants in math ed, but I also have to then box myself in a little bit to be mathy enough, but I always try to also, like I wrote in my career grant narrative inquiry, which is not usually a way that we study mathematics education. So trying to kind of both be in the discipline, but stretch it at the same time. So that's exciting to me and challenging.
I think for me, it's that when, I mean, education is urgent because it's children and it's children's experiences in their current lives. So I think there's a tension between coming to informed decisions quickly, but then also the amount of time it takes to do qualitative work and the iterative process and how careful you have to be in coding and coming to making sure you're coding reliably. And all of that takes a lot of time to do it right. And I think that that's always in tension with a sense of urgency. So that's always a struggle for me.
I think for me, one of the most rewarding things about being in qual research, especially I think where I am is we just have, I don't know, I feel like we have so many options available to us in terms of if exploring a topic, right? And I think we have so many opportunities to push the boundaries of qualitative inquiry. I think it's, for me, it's a very open field and a lot more I find, I mean, I prior to this, I was working in policy, a lot more accepting of different and creative ways of examining people's lives and experiences that I just like didn't find anywhere else. And so I always encourage my students to you know, take, like, put their spin on it and you know, be creative and because I think that's where some of the greatest like innovations come from, especially in qual research, right? When I think about like you know, people using their, you know, cultural experience and building that into the methodological process and their ways of knowing and what's important. I think for me that's what really drew me to qual. And what I think will sustain me and keep me here is that this ability to just constantly be creative and innovate, and that it's okay. And people in qual are typically very open and excited about that. So that's what I find really cool.
Thank you guys so much for answering that first question. We have another question that came through in the chat from Lori, and she stated a few important differences between being in an academic position and a tenure track one have surfaced in the presentations, the choice regarding the research that you do, plus additional responsibilities such as teaching. So what other differences might we think about as we consider each type of position? Good question, Lori. Thank you.
I And Lori added that she meant academic and non-academic. So she's interested in both spheres.
And I think there's a lot of variety within even an academic position. I'm currently in a 3-3, so like having the on a 3-3 teaching load. So having the time and energy within that kind of load versus another kind of load, or you know, that whether you're an R1 or not an R at all, I think there are differences within the academic itself. But I do find that I get to choose. Well, actually, now most of my research is centered around my teaching, so I'm drawing my research from the things that I teach because my load is a little bit higher. So I do think, even though I have some choice in the direction of that, it's a little bit similar to Liz, and where it's like these are the participants and the stuff around me that I have available to work with, and therefore I'm going to be kind of studying that. But I can also do the little side projects as well.
So I think it depends on what your academic position might look like. But for me, in a non-academic position, a lot of what I do is interfacing with program offices in the school district. So for example, and I'm blanking on the exact name of the office, but the office in the school district that is involved with health and wellness initiatives and physical education initiatives. And so a lot of our work is done in direct conversation with them, because they're the ones who are receiving the grant. And then they designate funds to us for evaluation. And that is the way it works for a lot of the grant funded programs in the school district. So our research, a lot of the upfront work in our research is conversations with them about what evaluation could look like, what they want evaluation to focus on, in addition to what the grant requires. So there's a lot of that conversation. But I think that if you're in an academic position where you're doing research with community partners or with other researchers in the university, you could also have those conversations. I think another big difference for me is that I'm not publishing, which is something that I happen to appreciate in my role. And that, you know, our work is going on our website and it's reviewed by numerous people in the office numerous times. So it's very high quality research, but we are not, you know, shopping out to journals and things like that I think take up a lot of time in an academic position.
Here's another question. Oh, Dr. Sanchez, were you also going to answer?
Oh, no, it's okay. I was just going to say like quick thing about the, even in thinking about like an academic position is, for me, at least, I knew I wanted two things in a career. I wanted a career where I could work independently, like without having a supervisor, because you just figure out like how do you work best? And I work best when I can work and focus on my own and not be, you know, having to report out all of my, like daily tasks. And I wanted a career where I had flexibility and time. And I think like, and not flexibility in terms of like, I don't work as much during the week. Like, I think we still put in like all of those hours. It's just a matter of like when you put them in. So those were two priorities in terms of like practical, you know, work style. But then I also really, really loved research. Like when I got to grad school, I was like, oh, this is it. Like I love to read and I love to write and I love to think. And so I wanted to go to an institution where research would be prioritized. And typically those are, you know, your R1s that have a more support in terms of doing research. And so I think really knowing, you know, how you work best is really important in this sort of journey.
Thank you so much. So there's a question in the chat from Cornell. He says, I am a DEIB leader in the tech space and own a small boutique consulting business. After graduation, I want to continue conducting research. If not connected to an educational organization, how does someone go about getting access to IRB processes, et cetera? So I guess kind of a general question about like being connected to research resources, et cetera, if you are not in an educational organization.
So the school district pays for IRB approval through outside agencies, and I'm happy to take a look into what IRB we've used, like Send the Link. I mean, it's called Solutions IRB, and you come across if external universities or external researchers are doing research in the district, they have to go through the district's own IRB. And I've seen a couple of external IRB agencies come through there because we require our own IRB process, but then also a university or an external IRB to conduct research in the district. So that's always an option, but we do have to pay for it.
Thank you so much for that information. Yes, and if you would drop that information in the chat, that would be great. I think it would be helpful for everybody to see that as well. And we have another question in the chat. Do you feel that qualitative research is getting a little more attention now after decades of SBR-driven educational research? And I think that kind of applies to any one of our panelists, so feel free to jump in.
I don't know the answer to that. I was trained at a university that was in a program that was really, really qual heavy. So I always felt like qual was the business. But I did prior to that, I did my master's at Vandy, there was a heavy quant focus, which is part of the reason when I wanted to decided I wanted to pursue a PhD, I wanted to go into a program that was not so quant heavy and that offered qualitative courses, because that's, while I was doing my master's, I realized like, oh, this is an interesting way of looking at the world and figuring out problems. I do see more folks like from the quant side wanting to learn qual research. I have people coming to me, you know, asking, like my colleagues or quant folks asking, you know, for ideas on how to do mixed methods and dip their toe in the quant area. But I think part of that is motivated by, yes, curiosity and also wanting to learn. But I think there is some, so maybe this is going to answer your question. There is some like call for people to be able to do both, especially when you're applying for large grants. They like to see that, you know, that they're you're using different methodologies and approaches. So maybe I can't say definitively, you know, but I do see more quant folks wanting to learn qual.
Yeah, and I think that quant is itself as being is open to thinking about the qualitative aspects within quant work. Like Ezekiel Roman Dixon's work is really interesting right now and looking at, I can't remember the name of the book right now, but I think there's more critical takes on the qualitative aspects of quantitative inquiry that are really interesting. But I do think there is a rise in this, in an interest in stories, to put it simply, and thinking about qualitative research and looking beyond the data. And so I think data science is actually, while it's on the rise, I think it's also creating a complementary interest in what's behind the data, which is qual. So I think that's interesting.
Thank y'all so much. We have another question. What have y'all found to be the most common qualitative methodologies in your work? And are there methodologies you would like to engage with more?
We have a lot of stakeholders, and we have over 200,000 students, and then their families. So we do a lot of surveys because we want to reach as many people as possible. We do a lot of coding of open-ended survey data. And recently we've been doing a lot of focus groups. So those are most common for us. I would love to do some more observations. I think observations are obviously done a lot in schools to improve teaching and learning. But I'd like to do them more for research purposes, because I think that that provides a lot of really rich data and helping us understand what's going on in schools.
I see, and I'm going based off of like what I'm seeing with my students and the things that like interest them when we're talking about methodologies. For some reason, and I don't know if it's because the readings that we do, grounded theory is always like very appealing to my students. They were always like, I want to do grounded theory and phenomenology, which are I think the two of the most complicated methodologies to do, like especially as a, you know, when you're starting out. But that always like, I think appeals to folks. In terms of, I think where I was, we did a lot of case study. That's because I did policy and policy and legal, you know, all that stuff they run on case studies and you know, replicating and that sort of thing. I use a lot of also case study, narrative inquiry and that sort of thing. I am currently exploring arts-based research, which I find to be really, really cool. And like another way to be super creative. I'm not an artist and I don't think I'm like super creative, but it's just like cool ways to help you see, you know, different sides of phenomena. So that's kind of where I've been playing around in my work.
Okay, I just did the uncomfortable pause for a second just to make sure nobody had anything else to add. And we have another question. So what advice would you give doctoral students still trying to decide where their research fits, whether it's within or outside of the academy or other space?
And I appreciated what Dr. Sanchez was saying about like what your priorities are for what you want your life to look like in a way. Like, so, you know, the dissertation is one little, it feels super important. And I know that like it felt super important to me, but then it's like, that's just like one little thing in your whole career. So I think that, that you don't have to know where your current research fits exactly, but to think about where do I want to go and what do I want my life to look like, academic or non-academic, and then also like what possibilities are there? You might not be and end up in the perfect job for your first job or where you thought you were going to be. But I think sometimes getting your foot, especially if you want to go into academia, like getting a tenure track job anywhere as a way to start is a step in the right direction. And then if you want to move to another space, you've at least had the support to do some writing and teaching and the things that you'll need to have on your CV to be able to get the next academic job in terms of academic jobs.
Yeah, and I think I'll just say, I'm not sure there's like a research that's like in academia and like not academia, or sorry, I'm not sure how the question was phrased, but I heard it as like, you know, this is research you do within academia and research you do outside of academia. But that's coming from somebody who does a lot of like community-based work. So a lot of my work, yes, I do it in the academy because that's who pays me and that's where I get the money to do this research. But my work itself is really embedded in community and with community. And, you know, it's that I don't do research on people, I do research with people. And so I think it's just thinking about, like Dr. Cannon said, like, what are your priorities and where do you see yourself? Where do you want to see yourself, I guess, even, and the things that are important to you. And that applies to the research realm, right? It's like, what are the problems, the issues, the exciting things that keep you up at night, as they say, maybe not literally, but the things that you can keep reading and reading about and never get bored with and never tire of. I think those are good barometers to kind of see, you know, what is something, again, I keep using that word sustain, but this is really about, you know, sustaining your life, your work. And it's a long, you know, it's for the long haul. and where you see sort of that being able to take you. And so I think your topic that you're picking now is probably something that it's a good like hint or clue in terms of, oh, this is something that's really like, you know, bothering me or keeping me engaged. So I think that's a good starting point. And then also keeping your pulse on, you know, society and what's important and what where we are evolving and developing as a people and what's mattering for folks. I think that's really important to think about because that's how you keep your work also relevant to, you know, current issues and contributing to helping, you know, solve the problems of the world as many as they may be. So I think that's what I would say about, thinking about your research.
Yeah, did I just lose everybody? Oh, no. Okay, sorry. I would agree with that in that I think it's not so much like the what, but the where and the who you're doing it with. I think looking back, I can find a thread that holds together all the work that I've done, but it definitely hasn't been a very direct trajectory in terms of like a line of research, but there's a thread there. But I think that what's most important is knowing you can do qualitative work if that's what you're really interested in, and then figuring out how you like to collaborate, if the people who you think you'll be working with are people that you will be able to collaborate with, and then also those practical aspects of where and, you know, if you want to be, you know, I'm working a 9-to-5 and that works really well for me, but if you want to be doing that or not, if you want to be at home or not, I think that those are things that can't always change when you apply to a job, but I think the research that you'll end up doing will shift as your interests change and as the context change, and as you know, people ask you to come in onto new projects, or you hear someone working on something interesting and you ask to be on that project. So I think the thinking about the practical things is also important too.
Thank you. So there's another question in the chat from Lori. Dr. Fornaro mentioned that she had an informal network experience. Are there any formal networking methods that you would suggest for non-academic positions?
I do think that AERA and AERA SIGs were still very helpful for me, even though that's more of an academic space. Other than that, I would definitely key into any listservs in your area through your university. Ask people you know in other geographic areas if you're interested in moving to 4G positions. But I can also ask around. And I can get back to you and see if there is something more formal for non-academic research positions in education.
Thank you, Dr. Fornaro. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's okay, because I'm sort of gonna lead into that other question about being on a 3-3 load. I was just gonna say like that those collaborative spaces and connections are super important, I think, to both your joy and your work and productivity. And, you know, so going to, now that we can go to conferences again, going to ICQI and going to ARA and talking to people and figuring out what they're working on and following up with them. Like I've never found someone that I tried to follow up with that was like, no, I don't want to answer your question or meet with you for 30 minutes and I tend to be pretty bold about being like, hey, that sounds really interesting. Do you want to talk more about it some other time? Or, so I think that's part of what's allowed me to be on a 3-3 and be able to kind of produce as much, as I've been able to produce. But I think it's also just, I love the reading and the writing and thinking with theory. And so it's not, you know, I'm doing it while I'm on a walk. So I think it's just like, it's a more than full-time job, but it doesn't always look like I'm doing theoretical work, but I am doing theoretical work, walking around the soccer field at my son's practice, you know? So I think, but my point was find your people, in whatever space they're in. And those people will know people that are like your people. And you know, then you'll find your space, hopefully. You know, like it might take a little while, but I think if you attend to those relationships, then you'll get where you want to be.
And I can also just go right into the question about helping illustrate the rigor of participatory and relational approaches that are often discounted. So the first thing is get your PhD. Like, you know, having that doctor title before your name, I think really helps people to be like, okay, like this is legit. Like I'm gonna listen to this person. I mean, as you know, I don't want to say silly, but it's just that gives you the authority to speak on such matters, right? So everybody, this is your motivation to get your PhD. But I think the other side of it is there's really no sort of like one moment or like a secret sauce to it. Is you just have to read a lot. You have to read a lot and think a lot to be able to string together, right, these arguments, these justifications, because that's a lot of like academia and research, right, is like being able to justify the choices that you're making, backing it up with literature. I mean, that's what you're trained to do as a grad student, because that's how you defend your ideas. That's how you tell people, you know, this is why this counts. This is why this is rigorous. This is why this is valid, right? Because it's been done before, because there's this whole body of literature or this whole context that we have not even considered that actually applies to this. So for me, it's being really well-read and knowing your stuff, so that when people ask you or they have critiques, that you can, you know, either anticipate it, or even when you're not anticipating it, you already kind of know, like, okay, this critique lives in this world. This is how I'm going to respond to it. And that's, I think, a really important, you know, part of establishing yourself as a scholar and establishing your authority in the field. Because I think it's not that it's going to be this way forever. It's just like, it's very new to people, for researchers to, you know, to say like people telling stories about their lives, make them expert, right? About this topic, about this matter. People have never heard that. They're like, no, experts are only people with, you know, letters after their name. Like, no, children are experts at telling their stories. And we, you know, help, you know, tell that story, and we help translate it into research. But at the end of the day, they are the source, right? They are the leading voice in this. And so, you know, repeating that helps. Repeating it over and over again and not backing down also helps. But definitely knowing your stuff and being able to justify the choices that you're making, and using other scholars, really leaning on other people who've done it before and who've done it really well and unapologetically, I think is really important.
Thank you for that. Cornell has asked, what advice do you have for folks from historically excluded groups who often have a hard time getting into the organizations and roles that could advance their careers and research interests?
Sorry, I was thinking, but the silence was so long. I was like, okay, let me jump in here. This is so tough. So, and it's tough for me because I'm obviously a woman of color, and I come from, you know, poor family, immigrant, like, you know, we have all of these different things that we come to this space with, a space of great privilege. And I often have to like think like, how did I get here? And just to like bring it back to the beginning, I got here because I had a community. I had like a collective of people from different pockets of my life that I was just like, look, you're the real deal. And I know you're going to stick by me, and we're going to, I'm hitching my wagon to yours. Right. And I'm going to support you, and you're going to support me. And just really finding those good and true people, whether they're mentors, their peers, their mentees, even, because even my mentees are so important to my success in terms of my happiness and you know, productivity in academia, right? They really fuel my desire to keep doing this work and inspire me. So people, right? Stick with the people who look out for you and that you look out for. I think I always say, like, I'm an opportunist in like the weirdest way. Like, if I see an opportunity, I'm signing up. Like, what is this? I'm signing up for it. I don't even know what it is. I'm signing up. I've shown up to things where like I wasn't supposed to be there because I just signed up and I didn't really read. I was like, oh, cool. Like, I'm signing up. And just showing up and just being observant and really finding, again, and it's in these spaces where you're like, oh, like Dr. Kayan said, you're like, okay, I'm gonna go up to this person and you're gonna be, you know, be brave and be like, hey, can we talk about this? Or can I, you know, can we, you know, discuss this more later or something like that. But getting formally plugged in is really important. Right out of, when I got into grad school, I looked at, you know, all the little things that are sent through the listserv. And there was like one opportunity that was like, join the student committee for Division G. I was like, okay. So I signed up. And that really, yeah, that really opened up a world for me in terms of access, in terms of privilege, in terms of being able to learn like the ins and outs of the academy, finding mentors. So don't discount those like little opportunities, or if they seem little, to sign up for these things, mentorship opportunities, just, you know, really putting your, you know, being present, putting yourself out there. And I know that's really hard for me. I'm an introvert and I don't really like socializing a whole lot, but that's, in early on, that's part of like the game, right? And just never, I think, and this is going to sound so cheesy, is like, don't forget who you are, right? You're in these spaces, but you don't tokenize yourself, right? Don't be that token person of color or woman or, you know, LGBTQI plus person, you know, don't be that person, you know, speak up when things are not, you know, when you're feeling like things are not going in a direction that's like appropriate. And, you know, there have been uncomfortable times where I've been like, okay, this is kind of weird, y'all. Like, I'm not just going to agree with this. Because I think at the end of the day, people will really like respect you for it and they'll remember you and they will, you know, look to you for more guidance. It also depends, obviously, how you say these things. But yeah, just remember where you are and remember, you know, where you come from and where you still are, and reach out to people like you or from similar backgrounds and bring them into the fold as well, so that you're not alone in these spaces. Because that's the goal, is for us to not be alone, not to be the only this identifying person, right? And if you are, to bring other people in. So sorry, that was a little preachy, but.
Yeah, it was
great.
I volunteered for Division DG as well when I was in grad school. And I think that, yeah, volunteering is a great way, because you're asking to help. And then we didn't have any kind of grad student council or anything at GSU, Georgia State University. So like I created one. I was like, we should have a group for doc students. And so I made a group for doc students. Now I'm underrepresented only in my womanhood and my parents didn't graduate from college, but I'm not, you know, still, if the space isn't there, how do you create it? How do you make, make a space that has the people in it that you want to be around?
Yeah. And I just want to add, if you don't get a response from a mentor who you're hoping to connect with, definitely don't give up and email again. Sometimes a non-response is just an indication that, I mean, I've flaked before and I still feel guilty about it. So, you know, don't hesitate to keep pushing that relationship.
Thank you all for those wonderful responses. We have another question. If you could start the process over again as a new postdoc, would you make the same choices or decisions? Why or why not?
Who knows? I mean, I kept saying during my PhD, how did I get here? Like, I didn't know what a PhD was as a kid. I had no aspirations of getting a PhD. I didn't know anyone that had a PhD. And I was going through a divorce and other things were going on. I kept like, how did I get here? What am I doing? You know, but it's just, I mean, the way I think with Broad, you know, in the post-structural way of thinking, it's like, well, all of these things are interacting to create this thing. So I don't think I could do it over again if I wanted to, you know. It's like every little interaction is mattering for your journey or where you're ending up and how you're becoming. But I think the things that I would do over would be to like follow the things that are exciting to me. And like, when I see a citation in a paper that's interesting, or I love one person's writing, to read all of their things and just to take that kind of joyride of like, and people recommending things to me, being like, yep, I'm going to check that out. So kind of like Dr. Sanchez was saying, like, what are, like, give me all the things and follow the things that are exciting to you or to me. That's, if I could, I hope that I continue to do that, because I think it led me into, I didn't think I was going to be a qual person. Like, I just liked reading qual stuff. And I was like, this is beautiful. And, you know, I almost quit math. And then my advisor was like, no, you can't quit math. So it's a little love affair that I have. But yeah, I think following the things that are exciting, if you have the privilege and luxury to be able to do that, or building the space for yourself to be able to do that if you don't.
I think that I would have a little bit more respect for the reality that at this level, job hunting is a job. And, you know, I was working, I had two babies, and it was not my priority is not the right word. It could not be my focus. And I think that it takes so much work and so much detail. And, you know, you can never reuse your materials, and it's a lot of work. So I just think I would have had more respect for that, and given myself more space to do that, like it is the job that it is. But that said, I ended up exactly where I want to be. So I think it was part of the journey.
And I'll just say quickly, I think I would have told myself to feel less guilt about taking time for myself. I am very big on vacations. I'm very big on going away. And in grad school, it was the same. Like, I would go away for days and stuff, but people would make comments like, you're the most vacationingest grad student I've ever met. And I would feel bad. And I'd be like, oh, am I supposed to not take vacations? And I didn't understand where those comments were coming from. I just knew that they were said to not make me feel good about taking time for myself. And I wish I had known at the time to say, no, actually, yeah, that's a good thing, because I'm taking care of my mental health. I'm taking care of my family. I'm taking care of my relationships. So don't feel bad about taking breaks, and don't feel like you have to be on the grind all day, every day, even though the academy makes you feel that that's like the norm. I think I would have, you know, maybe said some things back to some people about maybe they should take some time off themselves, because they can see if they can use it. So, but yeah, that's, I would feel less bad and guilty about that.
I feel like that is a beautiful final set of answers. The three of you have really given us some points of thought on avenues outside of what we're traditionally pointed to in the academy. And also really, I think for me, highlighted three things: one, authenticity within our work and what we do. And then also finding your people and community and the value and importance of that. And then finally, ensuring that you're following your passion and your priorities, which I think is something we don't hear in the academy a lot. So I really appreciated it. I know other people have mentioned in the chat that they appreciate it as well. Thank you for all of our participants for joining us. If you noticed, Carlson dropped in there a quick feedback form that we'd love to get feedback from you. Also, we'll be following up to everyone in attendance and registration with the components of our other activities that we do within our SIG as graduate students, and a podcast of this, so this can be shared out, because this is wonderful information.